the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And a very good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour, broadcasting again from Orange. And we were at the Renewables Conference yesterday, Emily Middleton, and it's continuing on today. Not here. They're doing farm tours and looking at renewables operations just outside the city.
They are. They've gone to some wind farms around the place, and our winery actually here in Orange, Cecil Wines, who they're an organic run vineyard, but they do a lot of renewable energy projects on their farm, so people are going and having a bit of a sticky pick.
A big operation, and they've changed things quite a lot. They're trying to use every ounce of electricity they possibly can, and also the wind farm as well. That's been around for a while though, a few years?
It has been a few years. They've been out near just past Cadia Mine, out that way, and they've been out there for a little while now. They've a few farmers part of that project. Recently, actually, one of the wind turbines actually got bent in a storm.
So much wind, it got bent.
It got bent, exactly. Mm. But they're all in the process of fixing that up now. So. Yeah,
and I hear that happens in Scotland as well, where they have to turn the turbines off because the winds there get up to 200 kilometres an hour off the coast of Scotland.
So, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, they have to do that quite regularly to stop that from happening. The other thing, too, though, is we'll be hearing a little bit about wind turbines and grazing with a merino breeder from Victoria as well a bit later on.
Yes, well, he has some merinos, and he's grazing his sheep underneath the wind turbines, but he's also doing some quite interesting things with the money that's coming in from those turbines, but we'll hear from him a bit later
and
on.
And we'll look at more of the economics of renewables as well with Andrew Whitelaw too. That's all coming up on the program. But before we do anything else, here in Orange, as we know, in Orange and also the Riverina, they've had some timely rain, some big rain, timely, sensational rain for some, they say, and sort of a real game changer. But I thought we'd talk about the climate generally with climatologist Anthony Clark from the DPIRD. He's joined us this afternoon. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Yes, and good to see you again. I suppose the thing is that big rain, it's sort of, people were starting to get worried. We had the rain come through, and now they're sort of looking ahead, aren't they? They're sort of saying, what's going to come in the next 4 weeks or so?
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly cemented a pattern we've been tracking across New South Wales. Really promising generally down south, out west. We do have some zones of concern, pretty much starting from Mudgee right up through that spine, up through the northern tablelands. So seeing some signs of dryness down around Bega. But certainly, you know, the last week, some big dumps of rain really set that trajectory up for a promising spring.
Yeah, that was the area, that was the shadow, the sort of the southeast have been missing out, very drought. Some areas there are really quite into drought at the moment.
Yeah, Bega, that part of the world really has dipped over the past 3 months. They did get a bit of rain over the last few days. It's a interesting system. They do have a little bit of buffer with irrigation in some of the livestock and dairy industry down there. So, but it's certainly something we've got our eye on.
Mm. Now, looking at some of the forecasts, though, and I know, well, and at the conference yesterday and talking to some of the farmers, they're a little bit worried about these forecasts of El Nino. Also, what we're seeing, I understand you've been in Europe, you've seen their catastrophic heat waves over there firsthand.
Yeah, certainly. We've just come back off a six-week family trip to Europe. Did manage to get onto a few farms in Wales and talk to them about their managing a drought, which for them is generational drought. It's one of the toughest. Certainly think some of our farmers in the central west here could give them a leg up in terms of their nutritional practice with animals and certainly that ability to switch production in times of drought and implement a drought plan. But, yeah, certainly a worry. El Nino, as usual, we have got quite a large El Nino event. They're calling it an intense El Nino event. For people out there, you've got to dissect that from the impact on the ground. Just because you have a big, intense El Nino doesn't necessarily mean, in parts of New South Wales, we're not going to get rain. In fact, it's actually a poor predictor, that intensity of the El Nino event. does raise the risk. As I mentioned, we do have concerns, particularly in parts of north of the state. They have a little bit more exposure to El Nino than, say, down south.
Why is that? That's just the way the weather patterns go?
Yeah, it's really a function of location, really latitude. You know, El Nino's the Pacific Ocean. It really affects that tropical, you know, moisture right. source. Down south, we've got a greater influence of the Antarctic and also the Indian Ocean, you know, affecting our rainfall patterns. Yeah, in fact, people who follow the forecasts and farmers do closely would have seen for some months now we've been forecasting dry. We've got this big El Nino, but we've been getting rain, and that is a function of an active Indian Ocean interacting with the Antarctic systems.
Well, we're sort of getting that timely rain, so people start getting nervous. It's warm and it's dry for a long time, and then they get rain, and then it starts again. We have the high system, and then they get rain. So it's sort of you're always on the edge of your seat, really.
Oh, that's right. That's particularly, I think, the case down south. Remember, you know, we have seen some improvements there for the last 6 months, but they've really managed 2 years of that unreliable weather. It is great to see an uplift in the storage of soil moisture in places like Wagga up through the grain belt. That's certainly really changed their risk situation from last year.
Now, you were talking about the BOM forecast, the three monthly forecast. So what are they actually saying? They're saying warmer and drier. They're still sticking to that now.
Yeah, the actual rain forecast ranges from neutral, so an even chance, particularly down south and along the coast, up to higher probabilities up north and in the central part of the state. Really stress, this stuff is only probability. You've got to plan across the range of outcomes. Nothing, no forecast will change that.
But we have seen record June, record July for New South Wales, so it's been warm.
It absolutely has been warm.
It's been a positive and a negative.
Yeah, it over winter, I think we've got good evidence now those warm conditions really extended the autumn growth period. We have seen a little bit more pasture produced and a little bit more relief from dry conditions off the back of those warmer conditions. But always keep in mind, as we tip into mid-spring, into summer, it'll mean a sharper finish. Those evaporation rates will peak a bit earlier. Forecasting temperatures got quite a bit more certainty than forecasting rainfall. The skill in temperature forecasting is quite a bit higher. If you've got real dependencies on temperature, either for timing of production, you know, you can add a little bit more weight to that warmer than average temperature forecast.
Yeah, and people are worried about summer, how hot it's going to be with what we've seen in Europe. They're worried about how hot it's going to be in summer. I was talking to some farmers yesterday.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to be worried. We've got to go beyond worry. We've got to get into actively planning for, you know, a wide range of scenarios. One of those is an intense, dry, drought-affected summer. Certainly we need to factor that scenario into our forward planning.
Appreciate your time on the Country Hour today. Thanks for joining us and filling us in on some of those things that sometimes get left by the wayside about what 3 months forecast means, what the BOM's actually saying. So it's good to get a bit more perspective on that.
Always happy to fill in the gaps and go a bit beyond the general conversation that's sometimes out there.
And with an agriculture focus too, absolutely. Which they don't always have that at the BOM.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Anthony Clark, who's a climatologist with DPIRD, joining us here on the Country Hour. It's coming up to 14 minutes past 12.
Landline explores the National Soil Archive, where the oldest sample just turned 100.
Yeah, we did celebrate. Yeah.
Did you?
We had a little team party.
Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
Well, let's take a little closer look at the cropping situation, because I caught up with, went headed over to the DPIRD to catch up with Peter Matthews, who's a technical specialist for grains, and we had a look at what's happening in mainly in the cropping situation around the state, and we heard about what's been happening in the Riverina and the Central West a little bit. So we looked at a little bit more in the north of the state, and I caught up with Peter Matthews, as I said, and asked him how the season is looking. It's actually good to catch up with you in person for the first time ever. I don't think we've ever met in person. It's always been over the phone.
Yeah, it has been, Michael. I've got a face for radio, mate.
So, you and me both. We've had a bit of rain in this region and further south. But I guess, you know, and it was terrific rain and fantastic. Everyone's saying it just came at the nick of time, very timely. But I guess the thing is, we need more, don't we, in the next month?
Look, the rainfall we got in southern and central New South Wales is welcome. It's put us on track now to get to an average yield situation. But we're going to need a decent 30 to 50 millimetre fall through August to keep it going forward. There are a lot of crops out there are well above what they should be given the seasonal conditions. The warmer winter conditions have been helping and allowing the late sown crops to catch up in terms of crop development. So growers are in a good position in that central southern zone. Further north, obviously, things fall away. They had some good rain through May. It followed into June, July backed right off. And then recently in this same fall, they've had that 10 to 15 mils in the north, which is enough to freshen things up. But again, they want a solid 40 to 50 millimetres in August to see crop potentials fulfilled.
So in the north, really, they have sort of missed out and they need a lot more.
Oh, they do. Crops have been relying on what subsoil moisture they had. And they were very, very lucky in late May that a lot of growers got between 60 and 100 millimetres, which recharged the profile, and that's what the crops have been surviving on.
Right, OK. So it's really, again, we've talked about this before, it's a tale of two states in terms of what they're, where we are and what stage we are in terms of cropping.
Oh, look, certainly, Michael. When you talk Moree versus Parkes, Moree's just ticking over. Parkes are back on track. Yes, late sown crops, but they're basically tracking above average rainfall for a lot of growers. And that last fall, again, they got above their quota. So growers have had to revise their cropping programs, revise their nitrogen management, just to keep in front of what they think they're going to get now.
And you were saying we need a decent fall of rain in August. Is that for everywhere, for the whole state?
Oh, look, everywhere, because the crop potential in the south now is lifted, so we need that big rainfall event to move into September. It seems odd, but September historically is quite a dry month. Certainly we get rain, but our September growth generally relies on good autumn, good August rainfall. Mm. So, look, everyone wants that 40 to 50 millimetres. Most growers have got all their crop management in place. The two issues that they've been making a lot of decisions around nitrogen management, obviously a lot easier in the central southern zone. In the north, a lot of growers have basically said, no, we're going to wait and see or rely on subsoil nitrogen levels to get us through. And then obviously, as things continue, they've got to look at disease management, because diseases never go to sleep. They actually like warmer, drier conditions through winter to tick over and be ready for a wet spring.
So the warmer weather that we've seen, like it's been record temperatures in June and July, warmest ever, I think, but it's been a bit of a blessing and a curse.
Oh, look, certainly. A lot of the state's crop went in what we could say later than ideal, but those warmer conditions allowed crops move through the development, and I've been moving around the state with my research program, and I've got crops in the north that are well advanced where they should be based on sowing time, but that's purely because of those warmer conditions, which means they're positioned well to get through to harvest if we can get that August, early September rainfall.
Are people worried about El Nino and what we've seen in those previous 2 months? They're worried about that, you know, that it might stop raining now?
Look, it's something in the back of their minds, but most growers have to be reactive to the conditions they see. So it's about monitoring their crops, making sure they know what subsoil moisture they've got there, where their crops are up to, and then making management decisions based on that. The worst thing they can do is say, look, I'm not going to do anything, because in the long run, in a lot of cases, it's going to cost them money and cost them income, which they need.
Talking about that, What about cost of production? I mean, we've heard about fertiliser, diesel prices, you know, going sky high. They've come back a bit. Are people getting squeezed and worried about the bottom line at the end of the year, even if they get a good harvest?
Oh, look, that's been the biggest decision maker. A lot of growers basically said, look, I can't afford fertiliser. It's not on the table. And then they've had to come back and revise that, because you can see the crops where growers have done the right thing. They're still holding their colour, they're actually growing, and then there are growers that have decided not to invest in nitrogen, and those crops are going off, and they're actually losing yield potential. So it's a catch-22. Do you want to maximise your year or try and save a few dollars? And I think a few growers have gone the wrong way.
Okay. So what do we need from here on in then? So you're thinking it can be dry in September. We really need it all to sort of rain in August.
Oh, look, I think from the state's perspective, we need a good 40 to 50 millimetre drenching right through the state, right through our cropping belt. And then hopefully we get some in early September. But normally it dries out in September. It is a drier month. It's like April. Everyone thinks that the autumn break's good, but we normally rely on March rainfall for April sowing, and then May rainfall to finish our sowing programs. So I'm hoping we're going to get a wet August. I know the predictions are saying drier than average, and now they keep mentioning La Nina, El Nino, but they've told us that it's sowing, and a lot of crops, a lot of districts are on average.
Yeah, and I guess the thing is that, as you say, September, but you just, and the thing is, with this El Nino that we had a few years ago, we just kept having little bits of rain or decent falls of rain, not like a huge amount in a week or so, but we'd have 20 mils and then a break and then another 20 mils and things like that. So it was haphazard.
Oh, look, as I said, growers have got to keep on top of their game, monitor their crops and make the decisions going forward as it occurs. I think we've got a good opportunity. We're certainly going to see grain production across New South Wales. It's just how much and where. And we can't just shut the gate and go away. We've got to be actively managing those crops to make sure they get the best out of them.
Peter Matthews is a technical specialist, grains, with the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. You're listening to The Country Hour, broadcasting from Orange, and it's coming up to 22 minutes past 12.
Nightlife with Philip Clark.
Informed, not overwhelmed.
The bill doesn't ban gambling. It doesn't restrict anybody's right to gamble at all.
Beyond the headlines.
How about this story? An AI assistant was asked to do something as simple as bookend gym class, but it decided to go rogue.
Fun conversations.
Just continue to get better and live forever.
Thank you. I'm going to have that as a goal, Trev. I can't afford to live forever. I haven't got enough cash.
Nightlife with Philip Clark.
Monday to Thursday from 10.
Across ABC New South Wales.
I think Phil Clark's telling a few fibs there. You're listening to The Country Hour. We were at the Renewable Conference yesterday. They're continuing on with some farm tours today, Emily. But you spoke to a really interesting farmer who's been around the traps for a while.
I did. Heading to Victoria is where he's based, actually. Peter Coy operates a fine wool merino stud and commercial flock, as well as a prime lamb enterprise and a wheat and canola cropping program. But in addition to these agricultural pursuits, Peter hosts a sandstone quarry and a 15-turbine wind farm on the property, and was with one of those turbines from the income stream from that one turbine, he's created a scholarship, and I spoke to him earlier.
Yeah, well, the farm has a rocky ridge running through it, which is actually an offshoot of the Grampians, and so that's what made it a good site for a wind farm. It's elevated, and the quarry is taking advantage of this. It's good hard rock material. And the quarry has been there probably about 13 or 14 years, and it's grown, and it's quite productive now. And somebody else runs the quarry, but they do give us a little royalty, which is very useful.
With the revenue from the wind farm, you were telling me that you've created a scholarship. Can you tell me about this scholarship?
I saw it as an opportunity. It's something I've always been aware of, what an advantage it is growing up in the country. With four kids of my own. But the advantages cease when you want off to tertiary education. The cost of living away from home and travel disqualifies a lot of country kids who are well qualified academically but just can't afford to get to university. And so when the wind farm came along, for the first time in my life, I saw an income stream that was guaranteed. And I thought, well, this gives me the confidence for a long-time commitment. And we suggested the scholarship, I said, to the wind farm company. And to my relief and pleasure, they said they'd match it dollar for dollar. So it started off at $30,000 a year per annum, you know, for one student. And it's now with CPI about $38,000.
That's quite a lot of money for any individual, you know, that might be heading off to tertiary education. A lot of people who see that income come through from these wind farms that might be coming on their property, and they go, great, this is a way to future-proof the farm if we ever go into drought or if it floods or whatnot. There is a constant stream of income, which is something that farmers don't often have, as you know. So I suppose, why was this something that you thought you'd invest in rather than, I understand that you future-proofed your place and added some cattle sheds, but I suppose what made you decide that this was a good place to put the money?
It's something I've always been aware of, and to see these kids, and I have to say, my daughter Rosa and my other daughter Sal, we heard of, as soon as this became available, it's something that's always been on my mind, and it's been so rewarding. And you're quite right, to get income that's guaranteed every year is quite unusual for a farmer, so I certainly see that as a great privilege, and you know, droughts do come along, so but there's enough there to support the wind farm, the scholarship, yeah, and it's been great.
Can you tell me how the scholarship works? So who's it for? How long has it been going for?
It's for local kids, sort of within a 50-60 mile kilometre radius. We promote it well. We get in touch with the principals of the various high schools where kids will be leaving every year, and they talk to their bright kids and say, look, you really ought to go. So we get quite a few applicants, and it's very hard for my committee to really make the decision, because you'd like to give it to five or six of them probably every year.
Oh, absolutely. So does it go to one student? It
goes to one student, and that money is really generally enough to sort of see them through the extra costs of living away from home for the maybe 4 years they'll be at university.
What's the feedback been from some of these students who have been able to utilise the scholarship?
Well, you know, we have an annual ceremony where we award the scholarship. And it's very well promoted. The local papers are generally there to cover it. And it's great that these former scholarship winners often come back. So they've formed quite a sort of a friendship group. And the feedback's been terrific. We've got about three or four have qualified now. One of them, incidentally, qualified as an engineer. And he's now working for the very wind company that built our wind farm. So the circle is complete.
I was going to say the circle of economy almost. But with the wind farm, then I suppose, is this something that you've seen other people do, or was this a one-off thing that you've just always been thinking about, like you mentioned?
Look, I don't have anybody else doing it. It's a one-off thing. I have to say it wasn't part of the planning, but it has created a lot of goodwill for our particular wind farm. As you know, there are a lot of people critical of wind farms and renewable energy, and so I think it's made ours quite a popular one. And one of the things I want to do here today when I speak later is encourage anybody that's thinking of promoting a wind farm or a solar farm that they might do the same thing, because there's country kids everywhere that are missing out because they haven't got enough money to go to university.
That was Victorian farmer Peter Coy at the Renewables in Agriculture conference yesterday.
Indeed, and we'll have a bit more about the Renewables conference, and we'll look at the economics shortly on the program. There's also a few other newsy stories around this Atomico plant, also that the telcos, there's a call for them to do better in the bush, so we'll hear a bit more about that. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
It's coming up to 12:30. It's time to get some news headlines. Adam's story's there. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. I got some news here about time ago. It's been
confirmed. That's fun.
But that. Oh, thank you.
I'm glad you. I'm glad someone's across it.
Thank you. So a $2.5 billion deal to support thousands of local jobs. The bill will be split down the middle between the federal and state governments, and Rio Tinto has also agreed to contribute just over $1 billion.
They were going to pull out.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought. But no, they're kicking the tin for $1 billion as well. There you go.
A billion between friends.
Yeah, what is it? Yeah, a bit of loose change there. Anyway, good news for the workers, though. The federal opposition leader, Angus Taylor, says he's cautioned his shadow housing minister, Andrew Bragg, about expressing his personal views rather than those of the coalition. That comes after a speech to the National Press Club yesterday where he suggested a net migration target of around 180,000. Angus Taylor says that is not coalition policy and that their policy is still in the development stages. The state opposition leader, Kelly Sloane, replaced the shadow planning minister, Chris Rath, as her representative on the Liberal Party state executive following evidence given at the ICAC. During yesterday's hearing, it emerged the senior frontbencher allegedly helped fellow party members avoid giving evidence. And today at that inquiry, the head of Catholic Schools New South Wales is currently giving evidence. And the whistleblower David McBride has thanked his family and supporters and the Federal Attorney General for granting him parole to serve the remaining 3 years of his sentence in the community. The former military lawyer was convicted in 2024 of stealing top secret defence material, which led to the Afghan Files investigation that revealed allegations of illegal killings by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan.
But he doesn't get a pardon. He gets parole.
No, this is just, serving it out in at home.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, and you'll be back at 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock it is.
Okay, well, we'll be listening.
Okay.
Mm. And let's find out what's happening with the weather. And joining us from the Bureau, Jordan Natara. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Michael.
So, still dry for the next few days? Is that what we're looking at mainly?
Yeah, so another broad area of high pressure across the state building as we head across the next couple of days. So, dry conditions for most of the part across the state. A few coastal showers developing as we head across the weekend. And then as we move further towards the next coming week, we are looking at the potential for some shower activity through the inland, mostly in the far west as we head through Tuesday and Wednesday. But there is a bit of model uncertainty if that were to drift a bit further towards the east, edging towards the Great Divide as we head towards the later part of the week. It is really not really a lot of rain in that system. However, it's looking like it could be a couple of storms here or there. So starting to see that sort of weather pattern, starting to see enough moisture combining with warmth from the inland of Australia. So we are starting to see that pattern shift from what we've been seeing in the past, which is obviously significantly dry conditions, and to one that we could see a couple of unstable days here or there.
So a couple of unstable days, and where are we talking that rain might be? You know, is it going to be mainly on the coast?
Yeah, so there's going to be two quite distinct areas. Coastal areas, for sure, is where we're looking at. So the higher pressure system as we move into the next week is going to be situated around the southern Tasman Sea. So onshore winds across the entirety of the coastline. Not seeing anywhere significantly heavy along those coastal areas. And then secondary to that, as those winds start to push over the ranges and feed into those warmer conditions in the west, starting to see those stormy conditions starting to build, mainly west of Cobar, really, as a whole. And that's going to be starting to be a feature as we head further from Tuesday onwards next week.
Okay, so it's sort of rolling, you know, rolling with a few showers here and there, but not a lot in it, you know, and over sort of a little bit here one day and then not much and then a little bit again.
Correct. So quite an on and off sort of pattern. No significant, let's say, highest focused areas of heavy rainfall compared to another along the coast in particular. And obviously noting that those areas to the inland very much going to be hit or miss, where we've got this sort of more likely showery and stormy conditions on the forecast. And even still, none of our models indicating any of those areas in the far west expecting any significant rainfalls based on the current modelling.
Okay, but not really heating up that much and not much frost?
No, so the pattern being obviously those winds tending now back towards more of an easterly direction, we're starting to see obviously cloud building about the ranges and then pushing over further towards the west. So cloud cover overnight is going to be a feature, driving those temperatures to be a bit higher than average, particularly as we head into the next coming week, where those winds are predominantly going to be associated with showers pushing up on those eastern side, and then obviously that rain falling on the eastern side, but still cloudy overnight conditions across broad areas of the state still.
And so is the high pressure the main feature for that 7 days, really, you know, with a bit of, you know, a little bit of rain here and there, but in a few showers, or are we likely to see another front come through in a few days' time?
The only system that, I guess, is closest to what we're talking about, which is, I guess, the frontal system, will be what's happening in the far west, which is more of a trough-like system, which has a front trying to move through that high-pressure belt. Doesn't really eventuate, and we see obviously the combination of that frontal system's energy being transferred into that trough itself, deepening it and seeing those showers become more likely as we head to more the mid late part of next week. But no strong westerly change similar to what we've been seeing over the last couple of days, where we see those strong frontal systems and windy conditions, and really the main pattern at the moment really is dominated by that high pressure system.
Right, okay, and will be for a number of days.
Yes, that's right. So very much just a quite slow-moving system, not seeing any significant change at the moment in that weather pattern over the next 5 to 7 days. And again, watching for exactly how things evolve in that far western area, with the potential that that trough may push further towards the east as we head towards the later part of next week.
Okay, Jordan, thanks for that.
Catch you later.
It's coming up to 24 minutes to 1.
Each weekday at noon,
we created the first IVF kangaroo egg.
Tune into the Country Hour.
Grow a variety of different garlics.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
It is better to be safe than sorry.
On ABC Radio.
And the cricket's on at the moment. There's a test on in Darwin. You can catch up with the latest details on ABC on the ABC Listen app. But Australia not going that great. We've lost 4 wickets in the opening session. Never lost to Bangladesh in Australia, but at the moment Australia 4 wickets down in the opening session. Yes, interesting. So ABC Listen app, and if you want to get on the ABC Listen app, you'll have to get some good telecommunications, and that's also been in the news as well, Emily Middleton.
It has been. The telecommunications watchdog has called for a root and branch review of how the industry is regulated, with a particular focus on regional services. The report analysed 27,000 complaints from regional customers, and David Claughton spoke to Lauren Pezzett about what prompted the report.
If you take a look at the figures, David, as a proportion of the population, the number of complaints in rural and regional areas aren't necessarily higher than metro areas. But the reason that the Ombudsman told me that they wanted to take a look at this is because it's actually more, the issues in regional areas are actually more critical. So that's why they've taken the time to analyse the 27,000 complaints over the last 2 years.
It does seem like a very high number of complaints, 27,000.
Yeah, it does indeed. And what the Ombudsman Cynthia Gobert told me is that it's more problematic in regional areas, so to speak.
The impact is absolutely different in rural, regional and remote areas. You know, when we're hearing from people the challenges that they're experiencing being able to access their essential services, the delays are so much more amplified, the safety risks are more amplified. One that really stuck out was a consumer that had to wait 5 months for a connection after 20 cancelled technician appointments and several appointments that went ahead and failed to connect. Like, I can't think of many worlds where that would be considered reasonable.
Yeah, so that's the telecommunications industry ombudsman Cynthia Gobert. They're talking about why they decided to do the report. And, yeah, there was certainly a lot in it.
And we were hearing quite a lot of complaints about people about 000 calls not getting through and people just not really responding to some of those issues. So what were some of the key findings out of the report?
Look, one of the really comprehensive themes that I found reading the report is that people understand in the bush that they might not have the same level of coverage as, you know, people in the city might, but there is a real disconnect there with getting issues fixed and a delay in getting issues fixed. And the example that the Ombudsman just told there about, you know, even just trying to get something connected, you know, having to make 20 appointments and then constantly being cancelled, and then when a technician does turn up, it's not happening. happening, because, you know, out in the bush, you're more isolated, and if you can't get something fixed on the phone, you can't just walk into a telco to get that fixed. So people just felt like they just weren't being understood when they tried to get something fixed, and it just wasn't reasonable. You know, I spoke to Jerry McLaughlin, who's lives on a property just south of Conjola on the south coast, and he was saying that out of nowhere found his phone connecting to text-only satellite on Telstra, despite him having access to multiple networks on his property if he needs to. And, you know, he tried to get an answer out of Telstra about what actually happened, and here's how he said that played out.
And then I rang them up, and they were told me that if you need emergency service, just text a friend and get them to call it. I actually said to the person, how is it possible for you to text in an emergency?
So that's Jerry McLaughlin there from Conjola. And, you know, what Telstra failed to tell him is that, you know, if you wanted to make an emergency call, if you have Optus or TPG, you can actually camp on to make 000, but they just wouldn't, you know, explain that to him. So I think it's a really good example about how there's just this disconnect there about what customers are asking and what the telcos and how they're going about and trying to fix them.
Yeah. Available. And the response to call a friend is pretty troubling. So what about recommendations? Right.
Well, look, there's several, there's 11 specific recommendations. They range from, you know, trying to, you know, introduce legislation to make timely rectifications a reality. There's also some legislation recommendations in there to modernise ID requirements. The Ombudsman said that's particularly an issue in Indigenous areas, but also regional areas when, you know, you can't just physically go into a store. But there is one overarching recommendation where the Ombudsman has called on the Communications Minister to undertake a root and branch review of the whole system and the regulatory framework that governs how telcos operate. Yet another review. We've talked about.
Well, that's
a lot
the big
of
question,
the
isn't it? There've been a lot. So why another review? Isn't that kind of pointless?
Well, there's a lot of them out there, and it's something that I did ask the Ombudsman about, because there's a lot of them that have been gathering dust. There are a couple of recommendations that the government has picked up on. They are taking a look at temporary disaster roaming, which, you know, say the Telstra network tower gets knocked out in a bushfire, you'll still be able to access an Optus network if that is available, which is slightly different to a 000 specific call. So that's underway. The government is also looking to mandate minimum standards for outdoor mobile service across the country as well. That's currently before Parliament. It was supposed to be debated on Tuesday and then yesterday, and it is again expected today. I'm not sure if it made it onto the final run sheet. But, you know, I spoke to Helen Haynes, the independent member for INDI, about this, because she's actually working on a bunch of amendments around this this legislation, actually, including the requirements around fault rectifications, that kind of thing. She kind of was didn't necessarily criticise the need for a report. She said that that would be a good thing, but also that we do have quite a lot to get on with in terms of recommendations and solutions that are already there. And I should also mention, I briefly touched on the ACCC is also, you know, undertaking a review at the moment into domestic roaming, and they're looking at, you know, wholesale network requirements in regions more generally and what they could compel the telcos to do. The difference with the ACCC review is that the ACCC actually has powers on its own to not just make recommendations, but actually to make directions.
Lauren Pezzett speaking with David Claughton about the Telecommunications Ombudsman report on regional communications. And the recommendations include setting up an independent database similar to the US National Broadband Map that shows what services are available in a particular area. And a Telstra spokesperson said they agreed the framework should be reviewed so that it remained fit for the future. And you're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Emily Middleton with Michael Condon. It's 17 minutes to 1 o'clock.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
And just a short time ago, we heard about the Tomago smelter. So it's been given a reprieve, $2.5 billion in funding from the New South Wales and the federal government. Here's the Prime Minister talking about it a short time ago.
This is an arrangement that will deliver additional clean energy for New South Wales and for Australia. It will deliver on manufacturing jobs. It will deliver on keeping not just the 1,000 jobs which are here direct and 5,000 indirect in this region, but the many tens of thousands of jobs that come from us being a country that makes things. And aluminium is an essential product. The idea that we see it and allow this facility to just disappear would have had consequences. We cannot afford to be at the end of supply chains. We need to be a country that makes things. And there is nowhere better in Australia that has a history of making things than the Newcastle and Hunter regions. This commitment, $2.5 billion, shared 50-50 between our federal Labor government and the New South Wales Labor government led by Chris Minns, is being backed as well by additional investment from Tomago in their future. Labor governments will back Newcastle and the Hunter, and the bloke who speak next will continue to do that. That will be on the next election as well. The Premier of New South Wales, Chris Minns.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Prime Minister. Thanks so much to all my colleagues. Thanks to everybody from Tomago, the unions that are here. This is a community that is reindustrializing in so many ways, whether it's in mining, whether it's returning manufacturing to the old BHP site or right here at Tomago. And I'm very proud to lead a government that's, with the federal government, saved Tomago and brought back train building to the Hunter. We have got a proper plan for this region that involves good, well-paid jobs deep into the future. If you look at the Liberals in South Australia or the Democrats in Michigan, they presided over the deindustrialisation of those regions. We are never going to do that for the Hunter. This area, this region has got a proud history and an even brighter future, and that's secured today with today's announcement. I'm going to pass over to Marcus, Senior Delegate on site.
Hi, good morning, and thank you. Look, I just want to focus a little bit on today. It's a good day. It's been a culmination of a lot of work that's gone on behind the scenes. Obviously, large industry, heavy industry, it's an unforgiving environment. It can be an unforgiving environment. And so to stay focused with that hanging over your head of whether you are going to have a job after 2028 does actually weigh fairly heavily. So as far as the workers are concerned, I really want, they're the heroes of this. They're the ones that have kind of kept themselves safe and everyone else around them and kept focused on what we should be doing and making aluminium. I'm happy that, now it shores up that future for all the employees moving forward. Thank you.
I've got Tom Crowley, who's on standby for me from Parliament House in Canberra. Tom, can you go through some of the key details of this $2.5 billion spend?
The Tomago deal, $2.5 billion between the New South Wales and federal governments, split evenly, but I would say split evenly with an asterisk here, because the federal government's contribution is uncapped, and should there be cost overruns here, noting that this isn't just a simple lump sum that goes to Tomago, this is an agreement to subsidise their power, essentially, which is 30 to 40% of the business cost of this smelter. Rio Tinto had a deal with AGL for relatively cheap power. It's set to expire in 2028, and it was that prompted Rio Tinto to threaten to close the smelter. Anthony Albanese, it was a much wetter day the last time he was at Tomago in December, when he promised to figure out some sort of solution to give the workers at that smelter some security. Finally, the details have been worked through with the New South Wales government on how this money will split. And the answer is that the federal government takes on additional risk, additional opportunity as well, they would be quick to point out, because there is also some detail in here. And we kept hearing from the Prime Minister and the Industry Minister, Tim Ayres, what a complex deal this is and how much there is that's commercial in confidence that we're not allowed to know and that they're not able to disclose, perhaps. But there is some agreement that the federal government will take some share of profits should the smelter be profitable as a result of this. And so there is then some upside.
Yes, talking about the Tomago plant there, the $2.5 billion allocated now from state and federal coffers. You're listening to The Country Hour. Well, let's talk about the issue of renewables, because we're hearing at the Renewables and Ag Conference yesterday, we heard about climate, we heard climate change, farmers' concerns about that, wanting extra income. They talked about the move towards net zero and whether or not carbon emissions, we could reduce them enough and those sorts of issues. But we didn't really talk that much about the economics. So that's something I posed that question to economist and analyst with Episode3.net, Andrew Whitelaw, and I spoke to him about that yesterday. Andrew, I guess one of the things that I was interested in your speech on the podium today was this idea that you were saying, you know, it doesn't really matter if you're not really converted to this idea of climate change and global warming and those sorts of things. You were saying, you know, there are opportunities there. That's basically what people need to think about.
Yeah, so what I was really talking about was, like, I'm not a climate scientist, so I'm not qualified to talk on climate. I am qualified to talk on markets and trade. What I'm most interested in is how can farmers make more money? How can we create as much money out of every inch of land that we've got? And I think that is where renewables, and I'm not talking about the big wind turbine farms, just even things like saving diesel on farm, using your straw for biodiesel, or using it through bioplants. But I think this is a key thing. It doesn't matter if you believe in it or not. If there's an opportunity to make money from something, then that's fantastic. I don't believe that Scotland would win the World Cup, but I'm still going to watch them play, even though I know the result. But that's the key thing. It's like, if you can make money from putting in some extra solar panels, whether it's agrivoltaics, so you have the solar panels sitting quite high above your vineyards, then that brings you an opportunity to have another different income source, as opposed to a commodity, which, let's be honest, all commodities in the last 5 to 10 years have faced a lot of volatility. So if you can get a guaranteed check every month for X amount, it just allows you that flexibility to do what you actually want to do. And whether that's concentrating on wine or sheep or whatever it may be, it's just cementing your business. And I think there's a long-term issue where over the course of the next 50, 60, 70 years, we'll need to actually be changing what we use our land for, because populations are forecast to potentially decline end of the century. So that's where the options come from. And biofuels are one of those options.
We'll talk about biofuels in a sec, but one of the other charts you put up was talking about farm profitability, and you were saying that we're going in the wrong direction profitability wise and that's why people need to think outside the box about other ways of making income, maybe.
Yeah, so that's the key thing. It's like, over the next week we're going to have, you know, announcements from the NFF about the $100 billion, they're having a celebration with Albanese, and it's not profit. It's value.
Just, yeah.
And so that's the key thing, like the $100 billion plan.
A lot of farmer profits going down.
Well, this is the key thing we're seeing, is that, you know, value of the industry is going up. We've hit 100 billion. Great. Fantastic. But it costs us 70 billion to get there. So it's kind of, our margins are actually not that dissimilar to what they used to be. And that's the most important thing for a farmer, is actually the margin, not how much value you produce if you can't sell it for much. So I think over the course of time, if we can just utilize our farms and the resources which you have, which in many cases might be wind, might be solar, might be your manure, what it allows you to do is reduce those costs, hopefully. And I think that's the interesting thing. And the interesting thing from this today, this conference, has been that nobody has really spoken much about climate change or emissions. They're talking about profitability and margins and the tools to actually help assist those. So I think that is the right approach to take.
And that was an interesting point that you make there, talking about what we've seen in some of those in Russia and Ukraine, that their stranglehold on the grain market, they can produce it a lot more cheaply than Australian farmers can in a lot of cases. That's a nexus that people need to think about too.
Well, I think that's the key thing. When we talk about grain market, we're really, in the old days, we used to talk about the US. Mm. It was what happened in Chicago. But now when we talk about the grain markets, especially wheat, we're really talking about the Black Sea market. You know, 30% of the world's wheat goes out of that region, and we basically, our prices will be dictated by whether they have a good year or a bad year. And they are having increasingly good years. And one of the reasons they're having good years is, part of it is technology, but a big part of it is
climate change.
So as the world gets that little bit warmer, the reality is that there's land in Russia that, you know, in the 1990s you couldn't grow because it was too cold, permafrost, that type of thing. But now we're getting land that's open up, partially because we have the technology and the finance to do it. But that's the key thing, is there's going to be winners and losers from climate change, and Russia and the Northern Hemisphere, sort of Norway, even Scotland, will do pretty well from climate change. But then there's other places that will do worse. So it's not all doom and gloom. As farmers, policies around the world do make a difference to us, and that is where we're sort of seeing things with the biofuels as well.
Andrew Whitelaw there, who's episode3.net. He's an economist and analyst. It's coming up to 5 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. As the federal and New South Wales governments split the bill for a $2.5 billion bailout of the Tomago aluminium smelter, jailed whistleblower David McBride is set to be released from a Canberra prison after being granted parole today. US immigration officers to get new non-lethal electric gloves. And Caroline Levitt will leave her role as the White House press secretary at the end of the month. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
On the country, our time for markets. First up, Wagga sheep and lambs.
Good afternoon. Wet weather impacted on supply with only 23,500 lambs and 5,300 sheep, and in the mix 2,300 suckers. Quality was very good, however there was a wintry looking portion in the mix. Limited numbers meant buyers stepped up trying to buy a market share. Lambs in shorter skins were paid premium prices. The market surged $15 to $25. Some sales are up to $30 dearer. New season's trade 20 to 24 kilo, 252 to 318. Heavy suckers, 312 to 362. Old trade lambs, 20 to 24 kilo, 240 to 310. 24 to 26, 305 to 332. 26 to 30 kilo, 325 to 368. Over 30 kilos, 365 to 450. Merino trade lambs, 208 to 304. Heavy merinos, 315 to 362. The mutton market surged $50. Heavy sheep, 260 to 350. Trade sheep, the better types, 190 to 224, with buyers struggling to buy under 900 cents a kilogram carcass weight. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
To Dubbo cattle.
Numbers remained very similar with a yarding of 3,300. It was a pretty good quality yarding with some good runs of young cattle to suit the processes, along with some top lots of well-finished ground steers and heifers and cows. There were limited numbers of young cattle to suit the feeders. Young cattle of the trade were firm, with the prime veelers and yearlings selling to $5.30. Feeder steers and heifers were up to 25 cents dearer, with the feeder steers selling from $4.45 to $5.70. Feeder heifers sold from $4.48 to $5.20. Following the good falls of rain over the last couple of days, young cattle of the restockers were 30 to 50 cents dearer, with the young steers selling to $5.76, while the young heifers sold to $4.90. Ground steers and heifers were up to 15 cents dearer, with the prime ground steers selling from $4.40 to $4.90. The prime ground heifers sold to $4.84. Cows were 12 cents dearer, with the 2 and 3 scores to the processors selling from $300 to $3.99. Prime heavyweights sold from $3.93 to $4.34 to average $409. Heavy bull sold to $4.26. This is David Monk in Dubbo for MLA.
To Yass cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers eased to 452. The quality was fair to good. There were good numbers of medium weight weaners and lighter yearlings. Heavy young cattle were limited. The grown steers and heifers in prime condition were scarce, and there was only 100 cows penned. The market did sell to a mostly stronger trend. The weaner steers lifted 10 cents, 500 to 568. Weaner heifers gained 12, 450 to 502. Feeder steers gained 5, 481 to 550. The small run of light and medium weight feeder heifers gained 12 cents and most sold from 480 to 522. Prime bullocks were 4 cents better, reaching 484, and heavy grown heifers topped at 455. Heavy cows were back 2 to 3 cents on the planar run. The prime 4 score cows, 410 to 415. The leaner 2 score cows gained 2 cents, 345 to 365.
Now let's go to Armidale cattle.
Just 561 cattle were yarded in Armidale this week, similar numbers to a fortnight ago. It was an average quality yarding, with most cattle showing the signs of winter and presenting in store condition. All major orders were in place for an overall cheaper market. Yearling steers to feed ranged from 510 to 568 cents a kilogram. Yearling heifers to feed were 40 cents cheaper. They made from 412 to 480 cents a kilogram. Light steers to the restocker were 15 cents cheaper. They made from 432 to 580 cents, while the light heifers to the restocker made from 320 to 450 cents a kilogram. Prime grown cattle of the processor were limited and topped at 440 cents a kilogram. Two score cows of the processor made from 308 to 337 cents. Three score cows were 8 cents cheaper and made from 320 to 365 cents a kilogram. Four score prime heavyweight cows made from 330 to 375 cents. And the best of the heavy bulls got to 401 cents. This is Hamish Osgood in Armidale for MLA.
And that's the market information for today. And brings to an end my visit to Orange. It's been a fabulous time at the conference, though, Emily Middleton.
Thank you so much for coming. I hope that it wasn't too cold.
No, it was. What do you expect? I mean, it is winter time.
It is.
Thanks for all your help, Emily. And we're heading up to news time and 1 o'clock.